Case number 13-5044, David Cantu et al. Appellants v. United States of America et al. Ms. Ferguson for the appellants, Mr. Scarborough for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court. The district court dismissed the claims of David Cantu and the other Hispanic farmer plaintiffs solely for failure to satisfy the redressability element of Article III standing. The district court's decision is in conflict with precedent in the circuit and should be reversed. The mere likelihood that a declaratory judgment in the Cantu plaintiff's favor would provide at least partial relief is sufficient to confer standing at the motion to dismiss phase. The redressability inquiry almost invariably focuses on whether the proper defendant is before the court. In other words, is a favorable ruling in the plaintiff's favor likely to redress the plaintiff's injuries, or will those injuries continue due to actions of third parties not before the court and whom the defendants do not control? Here, the relevant defendants, the people alleged, the agencies alleged to have caused the injury, were all before the court.
Let me ask you, if those same defendants, if they had decided instead of settling the Garcia claim, or instead of setting up this claims process, if instead they had decided to litigate the Garcia claims, and you believe that that decision to litigate rather than settle was racially motivated, unlawfully motivated based on race, would you have a claim? Is that redressable here? Could you come to court and force them to settle rather than to litigate?
I think the key here is that the agency of the USDA decided to set up an alternative to litigation, an administrative claims resolution process for some racial groups, but not for the Hispanic farmers.
So now, I understand that's your claim, but my question is...
I think your answer to...
it's a hypothetical, yeah, right? Yeah. Okay, but we do hypotheticals here. Under my hypothetical, if there was a racial motivation to the decision to litigate rather than to settle, what...
Yes, would have a claim, and in fact...
And what would be the nature of the claim? You would to force the government to settle?
It would be an equal protection clause claim. I mean, this comes up in the selective prosecution cases. You know, Waite versus United States, the Supreme Court case, says that even in an area where the government has a lot of discretion, prosecutorial discretion, settlement discretion, the one thing that the government cannot do is violate the equal protection clause. So if there is an express
and
racial
so the remedy
classification,
for that would be
if there's an express racial motivation, the agency is not
and
exempt
so the
from
the
judicial
court
review.
So the court would say to the executive branch, you can't litigate these claims. You have to settle them. That's extraordinary, isn't it? And a whole bunch of law. I mean, there's some black letter law you can't force parties to settle, and now you have a separation of powers issue, don't you?
Well, I think this isn't a situation where an agency is being forced to settle. The agency has chosen to set up administrative claims resolution processes, a process for adjudicating claims.
I understand that, but I thought you were back on my hypothetical, and I just want to know, is it your view that this court could force the government to settle rather than to litigate a dispute?
I think what the court could do is address the decision-making process that was behind a decision to litigate versus to settle. So if programmatically, institutionally, an
address
agency
it,
had
again,
a policy...
Right, and then what's the remedy? You address it and
right.
Let's imagine...
Well, I think the remedy...
Because we're talking about redressability.
Right. So I think I would like to focus the court on the line of cases that deal with declaratory relief as a remedy. And in particular, I wanted to highlight the Bennett versus Donovan case, which we cited in our brief, which didn't sort of fully discuss, but I think it's important in terms of the redressability here. And in that case, the plaintiffs were surviving spouses of borrowers who challenged a HUD regulation that provided insurance to reverse mortgages that protected surviving borrower but not the surviving spouse if the borrower had died. And HUD said there's no redressability here because the lenders are perfectly free to go ahead and foreclose on these surviving spouses. And this court imagined a series of steps that HUD could, in theory, take, fairly extraordinary things. The court said that HUD could accept assignment of the mortgages, it could pay off the balance of the loans to the lenders, and then it could decline to foreclose against the surviving spouses. And the court said, importantly, for purposes of this appeal, we do not hold, of course, that HUD is required to take these precise series of steps, nor do we suggest that the district court should issue an injunction to that effect. So simply the fact that the court is declaring a practice or a law or regulation invalid, if it's directed at an agency, the assumption is that the federal agency will take some steps to bring itself within compliance of the law.
So, Ms. Ferguson, your position is that there's redressability as long as some part of the harm can be redressed. It doesn't have to be a complete remedy.
Yeah, we acknowledge that we may not be able to get the full relief we seek, but courts in the Byrd versus EPA case that we cited and also the Made in the USA Foundation from the 11th Circuit, which dealt with NAFTA, even in situations where parties cannot get the injunctive relief they're seeking or the full injunctive relief they're seeking, if the declaratory...
Under your theory, wouldn't any claim against the government be redressable through declaratory relief? That seems awfully broad, doesn't it? Any claim, you just bring it for declaratory relief, the court decides what the answer is, and therefore... the parties will obey.
You'd have to establish that the plaintiff suffered a personalized concrete injury that's directly traceable to that federal agency. And if that federal agency
what if it was the president acting?
Well, there are situations where the constitutional limits on the separation of powers precludes injunctions against
the president.
We're
not talking about injunctive relief. We're talking about declaratory relief, right? And there's a big difference. So you're saying, as I understand the force of your argument, that the court could offer declaratory relief directed at the president, no injunction, with the expectation that the president would obey.
That's essentially what the plurality
said
in Franklin versus Marshall,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's a plurality opinion. I think what other courts have focused on more is if it's the president's being sued as well as the federal agency or subordinate officials, that one could be more certain that the federal agency will act in conformity with the declaratory relief.
And your position is that redressability is really about the right defendant or not, so it's not doesn't blow a huge hole in the restrictions to say declaratory relief in many cases does resolve the redressability concern. Am I right that you're asking for the court to order Rule 23 settlement class?
That was an element of the injunctive relief sought in the complaint. But that is perhaps an example of sort of full relief we may not be able to get. But for purposes of whether we survive...
That's been abandoned, that particular form. Given Garcia, it's hard to
see. The Cantu plaintiffs did move for class certification, and the district court dismissed without prejudice on ripeness grounds. So if the case goes back to the district court...
No, that's not the question. Mm-hmm. That's not the question she's asking. The question she's asking, I had the same question. Are you still... What you say in your prayer for relief is you want an order compelling defendants to provide plaintiffs with a class settlement that includes a class for settlement purposes under Rule 23 that is equivalent to that in the other case, right? I mean, that's what your prayer says.
That may be overly ambitious.
I suspect your problem in the district court was that phrase. I mean, when the district court looked at that, I have the same skepticism my colleague does about your ability. Do you think there's any basis for a court ordering that relief? Us, in this case?
I think the more likely scenario is that the declaratory relief might cause the agency to look at the framework and provide some added relief.
Yeah.
To take a closer look at whether there are some adjustments that could be made brought it.
Provide added relief where?
Well, in terms of the documentation requirements in particular, You know, these discrimination claims date back to the 80s and 90s, and in many cases farmers were turned away from applying. So you have a number of people who weren't even able to apply. Yeah. Those are called the constructive applicants. And under the framework for the Hispanic farmers, they have much more onerous documentation requirements. They essentially have to provide contemporaneous documentation of their unsuccessful attempt to apply or a witness. And that's very, very difficult given.
So this is really a merits question, but I'm just trying to understand what's at stake in your case. You know, to proceed with an equal protection claim, you need evidence of racial bias, not just a difference in outcome. And is it your position that this is a case involving facial discrimination because you have two groups of people who are explicitly defined by race or ethnicity or sex?
It is our position that it's an express racial, that the different frameworks are express racial classifications, and therefore we wouldn't need to show.
That's a little odd, though, isn't it? Because the reason that the plaintiffs are grouped that way was a choice on the plaintiff's part.
Yes, but it was the government's choice to offer an alternative to litigation, to offer these administrative claims resolution processes, and it could have offered one claims process for all groups.
That's a merits question, obviously a complicated question in light of funding and the Energy Efficiency Act and the litigation processes in the different cases.
And we did, in our opposition to the motion to dismiss, sort of challenge this position of the government that the class action certifications under 23B2 sort of compelled them essentially to adopt the different frameworks that they did. But as you say, that goes to the merits, and for purposes of standing, the district court was required to assume that the Hispanic farmers had stated a valid equal protection claim. And then the only question was redressability. And here, that wasn't a very high bar. And we met it. Thank you. I see my time is up.
Okay. Thank you.
Judge Griffith, to answer your question.
You have a double header today, huh?
I do.
Welcome back.
Thank you. To answer your question, Judge Griffith, had the USDA elected to simply litigate the individual E. coli claims, I don't think there can be any serious question that they wouldn't have had an equal protection claim at that point. And that's based on this.
Well, what if there was evidence of bias? What would the remedy be? Let's imagine a hypothetical in which racial animus said we're going to settle with these folks but not with these folks.
I'm not sure that there would be a remedy, Your Honor.
Really?
I think that it depends on circumstances. I mean, they've adverted in their reply brief for the first time. They've raised the notion of sort of selective prosecution cases.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of in addition to sort of being a waived argument because it's the first time in the reply brief. There are lots of differences.
It's an argument to their same claim.
Our answer to it is that there's a lot of distinctions between compelling or civil settlements and the constitutional protections that criminal defendants get, you know, when you're talking about the government using its power to prosecute people. I mean, in terms of right to an attorney, things like that, all sorts of things like that. But I do think that the fundamental point here is that what set these cases on a different path was this court's class certification decisions in Garcia and Love. That's sort of the root of all of this. And the fact, as Judge Pillard pointed out, that the plaintiffs, you know, different groups have sued at different times and gotten different outcomes in this case.
So you're saying you don't think there is a remedy for the hypothetical that I gave you? If folks at the Department of Agriculture decided on racially unlawful reasons, racial motivation, that they were going to settle with some and litigate with others, for the disadvantaged group, there's you don't think there's any remedy?
I think that you would need to look at the factors. You know, I think it would be a very high bar to sort of a threshold showing that you would have to make to get into court on such a claim. And in the Redondo Limos case, the selective prosecution case they cite from the Ninth Circuit, sort of goes through what you would have to show. You really have to
well,
make.
Let's say you could show it, then what's your remedy? What's the remedy that you'd get?
I'm not sure what the remedy would be, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm trying to answer as candidly as possible because it's an extraordinary situation. And it's different, I think, from this situation where you have the government who has settled a case back in 1999 in Pickford, based on the facts from that case, based on the fact that there was a class certification there, and decided to settle. And now you have, you know, years of litigation that have occurred in Garcia and Love. You've had a big fight for many, many years that I handled on class certification, and this court said, no, you're not actually entitled to proceed on exactly the equal footing that the Pigford guys. You're not entitled to proceed on the same thing. There are different facts in this case. You don't have class certification.
That's the merits.
That's the merits, yeah.
That's why you might win. That's why you might win. But why does that knock them out on standing?
Well, Your Honor, I think what the reason is that their asserted injury, the way they framed their injury, is the absence of a settlement, a class-wide settlement on the same terms.
Let's get away from that.
Their argument is not the absence. They do have that language in there.
They certainly do.
I agree with you in that. That language is definitely there, and I don't blame a busy district judge for reading that and saying, oh, nobody can do this. But their prayer for relief is actually broader than that. They seek a declaratory judgment that defendants' actions violate the constitutional rights of plaintiffs, okay? And it's arbitrary and capricious. They seek a permanent injunction barring discrimination. And then they go on with this other claim, which, as I said, I can see why a busy district judge looked at that and said, nobody can do that. But their prayer for relief is actually broader.
And let me just jump on that and say, assume a district judge entered the declaratory relief and the injunction that Judge Tatel just recited, and you're now
declaratory
government.
Relief and an injunction? What's
yeah,
the injunction
saying? Against unconstitutional discrimination in the litigation and or settlement of this case. What is your, as a government lawyer, asking yourself, do I appeal that? What's your ground?
It's essentially an obey the law injunction that says you don't discriminate.
That's your characterization. I'm saying that the district judge finds discrimination in the considerations that led the court not to settle the Garcia case on the same terms as it settled Pigford and Keepsigel, and found that that was bias, that was the reason, and entered an injunction against conducting the litigation based on ethnic or racial bias and a declaratory judgment that, in fact, those factors figured into the conduct of the litigation and or settlement. And that's the order that the district judge enters. And I'm asking you, what's the legal error in that?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I thought you were asking, what would we do? What would we appeal that? And I think that, maybe we'd just you'd be back at square one at that point. You'd be back basically litigating the individual ECOA claims on the footing that this court put the case on.
Is it unlawful for the court to enter such an order? Is it beyond the court's authority?
I think that we would have a very strong appeal on the merits because I think...
I'm not asking about the merits. I'm asking about we're concerned about the authority to enter an order that at least in part would redress the hypothetical finding of racial discrimination or ethnic discrimination. And so the question is, why is what they've sought, as partial as it may be, not enough to establish redressability?
Well, because it doesn't actually get them where they want to be in terms of their injury.
Not that, fully, they one, say, but they say that's as far as we can go.
Well, I understand, but that, again, that just gets them back to square one. And so that's sort of the basis of our harm argument.
What do you mean it gets them back to square one?
It gets them basically back to, okay, this is a case in which USDA, the case was put on a footing by this court in denying class certification in which what they get is the right to litigate their individually ECOA claims. That's what this court said. That's where the posture was. And the USDA then did something more and additional to try to, creative, to try to provide a more streamlined way of adjudicating these claims. And so if you invalidate that process, you're back to litigating the individually ECOA claims in court.
Let me try a modification of Judge Griffith's first question to you. Suppose we hold there is standing, and they go ahead and they uncover in discovery a memorandum from the department saying somebody proposes, look, why don't we just offer the same settlement that we did in Pigford? And there's a response saying, no, that was for African-American farmers. We're not going to offer the same thing to Hispanic farmers. Let's just assume that that's the memo, okay?
Hard pill to swallow there, but okay. Mm-hmm.
These are hypotheticals.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
Unredressable?
I think so.
Of course not. Why?
Because at the end of the day, well, okay.
You think that would be unredressable?
I'm sorry. Let me explain. Because again, I continue to conceptualize the injury in the way they've framed it, which is we want the same settlement as the Pigford. So that injury is not...
Don't change the case.
Okay. That's what they're actually asking for.
No.
As to your
they're alleging that this violates the Equal Protection Clause. We don't know anything about the merits yet because it hasn't been tried. But their allegation is an Equal Protection Clause question, and the only issue before us is standing. You may well win on the merits. There may be really good reasons why the government wins this on the merits. But it's a standing question here. Question is redressability. I asked you a hypothetical based on Judge Griffith's original question.
And I think at the end of the day, probably to seek a declaratory judgment that the program is unlawful, if you characterize it as a program, yes, that's redressable. They could seek relief.
So then this standing.
Why isn't this
No, but that's not the relief that they're seeking.
They're asking for declaratory relief, and you just put
But they're asking for declaratory relief in the hope that it's going to, lead USDA to undo all the claims what? Processing
no,
that
no,
is currently
done. No,
you're
reading that into the complaint.
No, I'm not That's reading
well,
that.
They may wish for that, but that may be beyond what the trial court can do. I mean, if you think about this in the context of, like, the plea, remedying a discriminatory plea, or even in the federalism context, remedying discrimination by a jurisdiction, the federal courts don't script out chapter and verse. They say, we see a violation, you go back and use your tools and fix it. And so here it would be, you go back district court and use your tools and the powers you do have and do what you can to fix it. I have a question, though, about the position that the government took on the voluntariness of the framework. It can't really be the government's position that because the framework is voluntary, even if it is offered in an ethnic, based on ethnic bias, the deficiencies that plaintiffs perceive relative to the settlement framework in Pigsburg and Kipsiegel, if it really were based on ethnic bias, the fact that it's voluntary doesn't render that beyond reach, does it?
Well, the point is that it's not something that they had to, that they're injured by, and I would...
Well, they would be injured if it were discriminatory. I mean,
They don't have to be in the program. And again, I go back to baseline
here. Let me follow up on that. That's a great question. So here's another hypothetical. Suppose there was no litigation. You've been involved in this case for years, right?
Yes, I have, Your
Honor. Okay, right. Suppose there had been no litigation, but all of the hundreds of the farmers, black, Hispanic, were just proceeding through the department's internal, it's the Office for Civil Rights, right? Whatever, filing administrative complaints, okay? And suppose the department said, look, we got all these complaints, there's thousands of them. We really want to help resolve them. We're just going to offer something to anybody who wants it. And, we'll offer some cash. We'll give everybody some cash. If they want to go through the administrative proceeding, they still can, but we're going to offer $10,000 to African-American farmers and five to Hispanic. Totally voluntary. It's a good deed by the government. Nobody has to take it. Not unconstitutional.
I think that there you would be able to remedy that. But,
of course.
But again,
isn't that this case?
But that's drawing, no, that's not this case. That's drawing lines within a program itself as opposed to settling different cases on different terms.
But that's
and those
the
are
merits.
The two.
That's the well, merits. You're back
well,
to the merits.
But I think we're back to the merits, but the merits are relevant to the way they have characterized their injury. Their asserted injury is they want to get the same deal. That's very plain. They want the same deal as the Pigford and Kipsiegel plaintiffs. The court can't order the same deal to be given to them. That's the essence of our position. So if nothing else comes through, I want to make sure that comes through.
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your double performance today. Very good. Does counsel have any time left? You can take 2 minutes, Ms. Ferguson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our point is a very simple one, that because the district court and this court is a reviewing court, must assume we've stated a valid claim on the merits, that in fact the framework was discriminatory, that all we need to show is that declaratory relief would cause the agency to take another look at this framework with the benefit of that ruling and consider whether additional adjustments could be made. Maybe we don't get the full relief we sought, but whether additional adjustments can be made that bring it in its entirety closer to what the other groups got, easing some of the documentation requirements perhaps, providing Hispanic farmers more guidance in terms of how to fill out the very complicated claims. You know, we're pragmatic about this, but our point is that under the case law, the case law that flows from Franklin, but especially this court's decision in Bennett and Byrd, the 11th Circuit's decision in the NAFTA case, one can assume that when a federal agency is told that your program is violating the Equal Protection Clause, that it will do something to address that. And that's all we need to show for addressability. Unless there's further questions. Thank you.
Thank you both. The case is submitted.